I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell.
Hello everyone, welcome back. It's a delight you're there. We really do enjoy your company. And thank you for listening.
I've had a lot of nice messages on Instagram. I want to give a shout out to Natalie. I told you this story. Natalie Crochets.
Crochets.
She sent me some messages on Instagram we were trying to work out ways to get more followers and more listeners. And she recommended our podcast, a crochet group with 35,000 people in it.
Good Lord.
So now we've got some new listeners. Hello.
Hello. Yes, all new crocheters. Yes.
I love the idea of crocheting and listening to...
Yes.
Thanks, Natalie. She's very good at crochet as well.
I met a man this week who said, oh, I love true crime podcasts. What's yours called? And I said, it's called Blood Ties. And he said, oh, yes. An ex-policeman became a driver for the government and now runs a high-end bit of, you know, chauffeuring. He was absolutely riveted.
Oh, nice. Well, hopefully he's listening too.
Well, I hope he is. If he is, welcome.
Welcome to any new listeners.
Welcome to any new listeners.
Well, actually, I did have a nice message from a new late listener lady this morning who said she just discovered us. A few new people have joined. Welcome.
Welcome.
Enjoying the back catalogue of hundreds of podcasts we've already...
Well, we have done quite a lot.
We have, yeah.
Yeah.
A lot.
Amazing.
A lot. Anyway.
But I think it was... I've been very impressed. People, you know, all of a sudden send me letters or messages saying, have you thought of this or what about that? Which I think is wonderful.
Very nice of everyone.
Yeah. What have I done this week? I've done more World's Most Evil Killers.
More murder, don't tell me.
More murder.
You surprise me.
Yeah.
My neighbour asked to borrow something from me this morning, and then I said, oh, I'm going to do a podcast. She said, oh, what are you chatting about this week? I'm like, it's murder again.
Yes. Well, that's how we started, wasn't it? I mean, this was all your idea. It came out of our lunches on Saturdays, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. It makes it sound like every time we had lunch, we just ended up talking about murder, which isn't totally true.
No, it's not true. But we did talk about it from time to time. That would be fair.
Very fair. We would have talked about the story about the Greek husband...
No.
Murdering his wife in the...
Which he can finally confess to.
The villa. And hanging the dog. And what an idiot.
Well, you know, people often say to me, how do you survive it? And I say, well, it's interesting because it allows you to see the good side of people as well as the bad.
Does it?
Yes. I think people are... I'm not a cynic in that sense. I do believe there's lots of good in lots of people.
Not in a lot of the people we talk about.
Not in a lot of the people we talk about, and particularly not this week, which I think is a particularly noxious case.
Yeah, it's a really nasty one.
There's nothing good about it. Oh, a little bit of an update. The Lord Chancellor, the Secretary of State for Justice, has agreed to question the parole board's decision to... allow Colin Pitchfork to be released.
Good. The general consensus on Instagram was that he should stay in prison and should not be let out on parole.
That's my impression, my firm conviction as well.
The listeners have spoken.
He's only 61. He could easily commit the crimes again.
Easily.
Without a moment's hesitation, which is actually a very good lead-in to the case we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, so this case was suggested to us by Jenny on Instagram. And it's the anniversary of the case, isn't it, Dad?
20th anniversary, yes.
Yeah, so it's the murder of Danielle Jones. Is that what we're calling it?
I think so.
Okay, well, here's the murder of Danielle Jones.
On the morning of Monday, the 18th of June, 2001, exactly 20 years ago, schoolgirl, 15-year-old Danielle Jones, I beg your pardon, left her home in East Tilsbury in Essex on her way to school. She never arrived. She disappeared into thin air. In fact, Danielle has never been seen since, in spite of intensive police efforts to find her body. The last time anyone really saw her was when she left the house. She was going to turn left to go to the bus stop, but she doubled back. She turned left and then turned back on herself and turned right. And she was seen talking to a man who had a blue transit van. That was the last time anyone saw Danielle. Danielle was a quiet, reserved, really a bit of a homebody, according to her parents. And she was suggestible. That would be fair, I think. One man upon whom the police interest focused immediately was Danielle's uncle, who was called Stuart Campbell, Stuart James Campbell, who was born in Essex in 1958. He had a long history of sex offences, dating back to 1989, when he kept a 14-year-old hostage and took what were called at the time indecent photographs of her. But he only got a 12-month suspended sentence.
Why? That's nuts.
Well, it was a different time. That I would say. It was a different time. He did the same thing at Jamie Reynolds. Remember all that case?
Yeah.
I'll photograph you. He was always persuading young girls, particularly teenagers, to allow him to take photographs of them, quotes, glamour photographs of them. Well, Danielle was the eldest of three, had two younger brothers, Mitchell and Ryan. And the thing about Campbell was that he targeted 15-year-olds. He had served 4 years in prison for robbing a 16-year-old in the street. His first wife was called Jennifer, whom he met when she was 15, and they had one child. When he met Danielle's father's sister, Debbie, she too was 15. He was disturbed. He was clearly a narcissist. And he was clearly ruthless. He, of course, trailed through paedophile websites. He picked up girls in the street pretending to be a photographer and coaxed them into posing in bikinis or lingerie. He particularly liked a website called Young Lolita Beauties. He first met Danielle's aunt, Debbie, in 1982. She was eventually to marry him. His family, including his mother, Jeanne, and his brother and his sister, disowned him because of his appetite for very young women. But Campbell, and I'm not overplaying this, insinuates himself into Danielle's family, clearly intent on grooming Danielle to become perhaps the third Mrs. Campbell. Although at one point he was calling himself Stuart Sharkey. He had a loose relationship with the truth. He was very plausible, but also rather creepy. But Danielle's family, her mum Linda and dad Tony, didn't know anything about his criminal record at all. As far as they were concerned, he was just a very helpful uncle who used to give Daniel a lift to school from time to time in his blue transit van. They thought it was a bit creepy, but, well, he seems well-meaning enough, and Debbie seems to like him, and what's to worry? Anyway, on that June morning, 20 years ago, Danielle disappears into thin air. It takes the police a very short time indeed to realise that Stuart Campbell has a track record of problems with young women. But then they're faced with a dilemma. And I do understand their dilemma here. They hope, and I suspect pray, that he's keeping Danielle somewhere. And so they put him under intense surveillance. They want to preserve Danielle's life, if they possibly can, if she's still alive. It takes them 5 days to realise that he's not going to lead them to where she is. He simply goes back to the house he shares with Debbie. Nothing else. And so on the 23rd of June 2001, they arrest him. Campbell maintains stoutly, firmly, that he had nothing to do with it. He doesn't know where she is. And as far as he's concerned, this is intimidation. It's only because I've got a record. Now, the school rang Danielle's parents literally an hour after the school had begun. In other words, about 10 o'clock that morning, and saying, is she all right? Because she hasn't turned up. Well, as far as Linda and Tony are concerned, she's perfectly all right. She's gone to school. Did he groom her? Well, I think he did. They were aware, Mum and Dad were aware that this relationship was not wholly sensible. And she herself, I think, tried to disengage, or so it was said. But he was very plausible. Did he try and persuade her to pose for him again? Did he say, oh, I'll give you a lift to school? Did he say, he used to call her sexy legs in the house, which is a bit creepy, isn't it? Molly's nodding her head. But why that particular day? It was a Monday morning. It was summer. What was it about that particular day? We won't know. We don't know. As I say, on the 23rd, on the Friday of that week, the police arrested him. And he was incredibly uncooperative. In one interview, he replied no comment to 50 questions. He was surly, defensive, unpleasant. Perhaps a little bit of background we should give you on Campbell. He was a bodybuilder and a builder. He liked, muscles. He was an Essex boy. He used various names. I believe, and I hope that this isn't too gloomy, I believe that Campbell thought that he'd hidden Danielle's body so effectively the police would never find it. 400 members of the public and 60 police officers launched a hunt, but nobody found anything. 900 officers altogether searched 1,500 locations over 2 months, because by this point they were convinced that she was dead and he'd hidden the body. Campbell was released on police bail and then in August, on the 17th of August, he was rearrested. And this time the police had a search warrant for his house, in which they found a blood-stained stocking in his lift, in his loft, with DNA matching his and Danielle. They also found Danielle's lip gloss, a diary of his, indicating his, what can only be described as an obsession with the teenager. And for the first time, they began to look closely at the mobile phone evidence. Back in the very early 2000s, mobile phones weren't as decisive as they are now in murder inquiries. Because as we all know now, but we didn't then, the precise location of a mobile phone can be tracked from the mast that it's pinging off. That's now.
Could that always be? Was it like that with the old ones?
Yeah, it was always like that, but we didn't know as much about how it worked, mobile telephony, as it worked at that time. The search for the body continued and continued. There was a Crime Watch appeal on television in July 2001. But by November 2001, the Crown Prosecution Service had agreed there was enough evidence to charge him with the murder of Danielle Jones, even though there wasn't a body. He came up for trial in October 2002 at Chelmsford Crown Court. One of the decisive pieces of evidence was a mobile phone message which he purported had come from Danielle. It said, "Hi Stu, thanks with Z for number four being so nice. You are the best uncle ever. Tell Mum I'm so sorry. Love you loads, Dan. Three kisses." It was all typed in capital letters. And part of the evidence in the case against Campbell was that Danielle never typed in capital letters. It was the first time in a trial of this kind where what's now known as forensic authorship analysis applied to a mobile phone message. It also pointed out that when this message was sent to his phone, the phones were together.
He obviously sent the message.
He sent the message to himself. His alibi of being in a DIY store, do-it-yourself store in Rayleigh in Essex, at the time of the disappearance, fell apart because his mobile phone wasn't the DIY store. It was much nearer to Danielle's home. He also had to happen to have in his belongings, which came to the surface when the police searched his house, he had a note of the PIN number to open Danielle's phone. Well, not surprisingly, the jury were not convinced by his protestations, although they did not hear about his previous record. The people who were shocked about his previous criminal record, of course, were Danielle's parents, who had no idea of his predilections. This was, as far as they were concerned, a homebody, shy girl who had a not particularly sensible relationship with her uncle. In the end, the jury convicted. They convicted him of abduction and of murder. I wouldn't say it was open and shut, but it was very clear. The sentence was 10 years for abduction and life with a minimum of 20 years for the murder. In 2004, subsequent to his conviction, he appealed on the grounds that his diary and his obsession with young girls shouldn't have been included. And what that one of the jurors, and I like this particularly, one of the jurors live next door to policemen.
What difference does that make?
I can't imagine. He continued to refuse to say where he disposed of Danielle's body. The immediate parallel with this case, of course, is Helen McCourt, who was murdered by Ian Sims in Liverpool in 1988 and whose body was never found. Helen McCourt's mother conducted a campaign that Sims should not be allowed out of jail until he disclosed where he'd put her daughter's
We've
body.
We've talked about this before.
Helen's, so-called Helen's Law, which has now passed into law in this country. And so on the 20th anniversary of Danielle's death, this week, his mother again appealed to Campbell to reveal where he'd hidden the body. He didn't do so. The police described his relationship with Danielle as certainly inappropriate and probably unlawful. In 2017, long after the conviction in 2004, they searched a garage block in Thurrock in Essex, presumably on the basis of some kind of intelligence. But, as we've seen so often, nothing was found, and there's no sign to this day of Danielle's body. According to the sentence, Campbell is eligible for release this year. And there's already been an outcry, we've talked about it, about Colin Pitchfork, and there will be an outcry about Campbell. Because he hasn't told anybody what happened to Danielle. He has been convicted. There's no doubt in anybody's mind that he was the guilty party. And one of the things about Helen's Law in Britain is, although it now insists that the parole board take into account the fact that the perpetrator hasn't disclosed the whereabouts of the body, it doesn't insist. In other words, he can say, I've no idea. It isn't 100% guarantee that an offender will not be allowed out of jail. Campbell remains one of the nastiest people we've talked about.
He shouldn't be let out of prison. He definitely could commit another offence.
Well, he, as we now know, he's only 63. He was born in February 1958. He's 63. Not too old to commit another crime.
No way.
Not too old to target another 15-year-old.
No way.
Not too old to pull off the same stunt. And to be fair, that part of Essex in the south of England, a lot of marshes, a lot of marshland, a lot of estuaries. Who knows what happened to the body? Weighted down.
So awful.
And here's this homebody, this home-loving girl, who disappears off the face of the earth. And a man who, in my mind, there can be no doubt, killed her and was convicted of the killing, has never disclosed where the body is. And it's the same old power and control argument we've talked about so often. It's the last power the murderer has. I won't tell the family where the body is.
Mm.
It's the last power and control element. It is horrifying, genuinely horrifying, but it happens time after time. We've talked about it time after time.
And especially, with children, it's so awful.
Yes. The other thing about this case is, again, and we've talked about it about Pitchfork, with the legislation that's about going through Parliament at the moment, child killers will not be eligible for parole.
Oh, yeah, true. That's good.
Well, but it won't stop.
It won't stop
Campbell coming out.
Campbell
has persistently appealed for parole. Relentlessly.
Lock him up and throw away the key, I say.
No. One of the things about this is there is an interesting side issue here. A girl called Tia Riggs, who was aged 12, was killed in 2010 by her paternal uncle. There is a slight history of what you might describe as familial murder. But again, it very much depends on the character of the family. All I would
say that though, that it's, you know, those kind of things, it's more often than not someone you know.
Yes, and someone you know well, probably. I mean, Uncle Stu, as far as anybody knew, was a perfectly upright citizen.
April, what's her name? That was a family.
Yes, April Jones. Mm. Yeah. Mark Bridger.
Mm.
Yeah. But you can see how. And again, we come back to this so often, darling, don't we? People don't expect the worst. They expect the best. Tony and Linda Jones didn't expect.
Yeah, but you just said you don't want to be cynical. Like, no one wants to go around thinking everybody's... You know, but it's bad that nobody knew about his previous.
Yeah.
How does the law work in that respect? You don't have to disclose any of
that. No, innocent until proven guilty.
But was he convicted of...
He spent 4 years in jail.
But now would he have to say that he was on the sex offenders register?
Yes, he would, yes.
So it would be different.
It would be a little different, yeah. But it's so... I understand the parents so well. You know, they could have been so trusting. It's very difficult to think bad of everybody. And he was very, very plausible. But it's, I think, one of the more chilling stories that we've told, because this is a perfectly nice, ordinary girl who goes missing on her way to school on a Monday morning and is never seen again. It sends a shiver down my spine, really. And the other thing, I suppose, the most difficult call of all, was the police's decision not to arrest him immediately after
Straight
her disappearance.
Away.
Now, it's a very tough call, and I'm not trying to second-guess them at all.
Well, because he had taken someone hostage before, they thought it's best to do that, so he can sort of follow.
So he can follow him.
Yeah.
And see what happens.
Hoping that he'd kept her somewhere.
And who's to say, if you were the senior investigating officer, you wouldn't have made the same decision.
Mm. Yeah. It was a sensible thought. It wasn't like, you can totally justify, it wasn't like stupid policing. It makes total sense to do that.
And it made every sense to watch him. But sadly, the damage had already been done.
Mm.
I suspect, in fact, I'm pretty certain.
Did they search the van?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there was no evidence in the van. I'm pretty certain she was dead very quickly.
Mm.
Poor Danielle.
Well, that was really sad.
It is, I'm afraid, a very sad case. And it's the 20th anniversary.
Mm.
And her parents still have not got closure. I don't like the word closure very much, but they have still got no idea
where she is.
Where she is.
It's just so hard. And it's so awful because he knows and just doesn't say. And
that's right.
It's so cruel.
I think it's the most profound kind of cruelty.
Yeah, it really is.
I mean, the case that always sticks in my mind is, of course, dear poor Keith Bennett, the 14-year-old. Who was killed by Brady and Hindley. Mm. And Brady never disclosed where he'd buried Keith Bennett on Saddleworth Moor. I suspect, I hate to say this, but I suspect he'd finally forgotten. I suspect he couldn't quite remember. He went back to the moor at least three times with the police. I suspect he'd just forgotten. I don't think the same applies to Stuart Campbell.
No, me neither.
I'm pretty sure he knows exactly where the body is. He isn't prepared to say. And so that, I'm afraid, on that rather sad note, is the murder of Danielle Jones.
Well, thank you. Good case, good to be reminded of.
Yeah.
Especially now.
Yes, as I was saying to you, Mo, ironically, I've recently done a television documentary on the case. The parents are still distraught.
Yeah, obviously. Horrendous.
You can't forget.
The worst thing that could happen.
You know, it transforms your life in an instant.
Absolutely.
The same as Helen McCourt, you know, the disappearance of Helen McCourt. It's the worst kind of torture. Not knowing where your child has gone.
Yeah.
And whoever killed her doesn't tell you, won't tell you. I have almost more sympathy for killers who in the end take the police to the site, the body, site of the bodies. But then, of course, you can get the other way round, particularly a case in America, that if you collaborate with the police and take them to the remains, you can plea bargain out of the death penalty. So it's a very blurry area.
Well,
hey, let's talk about something cheerful.
Something cheerful.
How's your week been?
Fine, yeah. I went to the theatre.
Good Lord.
I know. First time.
Crikes.
Crikey.
What was it like?
Yeah, it was fine, actually. It was quite nice, apart from you have to wear a mask all the time, because you obviously there's social distancing, so you don't have to sit next to anyone and there's no one in front of you.
Well, I suppose that's rather a good thing.
That's quite good.
What did you see?
My client Tom is in, well, it's like very COVID appropriate. They're sort of three one man, one woman plays, and they're new writing. He had done one by this writer called Simon Stevens, who I think is a genius.
Very good.
He was very good. It was very good.
And where was it?
A Lyric Hammersmith.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Bit of a schlep from me.
Yeah, a bit of a trip.
Bit of a way, but anyway, it was very good. It was my first foray into back to theatre land.
Well, that's jolly good. I haven't been to the theatre yet. I talked to a lot of people who seem to have been, and all of them do object to wearing masks. I think it's that really gets them down.
Well, it's a bit silly that you can go to a restaurant or a pub and not wear a mask, but you have to wear one in the theatre. It's a bit weird.
It is odd.
Yeah.
But I think also it's odd that, you know, we're having these massive events like the British Grand Prix with 140,000 people there and you can't go and see a play.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes no sense.
It doesn't make any sense.
The Wimbledon final is going to be completely full, 20,000 plus.
Yeah, the rules are very odd. You can't go to school sports day, but you can go...
To Twickenham.
You can put... tens of thousands of football fans in Leicester Square.
Or you can't go to sports day, but you can go and watch the Euros final at Wembley with 60,000 people. Makes no sense.
Yeah, it's very weird. But, you know, that's not the only scandal running through government this week.
That would be true. But for those of our listeners who aren't in this country, we'll gloss over that one.
It's funny, though.
It's the hypocrisy we are surrounded with takes my breath away.
It is funny. Well, thank you, Jeffrey, and thank you to all the people that help us, our producer Sam Brain, my brother Dan, who did the music, my friend George, who drew our caricature, to Audio Boom for hosting us, and to Jeffrey for doing all the hard work, and to you, the listeners. We're nothing without you.
Especially to you, the listeners, and as I always say, and mean it, thank you to Molly, who came up with this idea, and it's been a delight, and is still a delight every time we do it. We both enjoy it. So thank you for listening. And as I often say, do be careful out there.